Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 32 of Game On with Cody and John.
On this episode's Big Deal,
the Jones Theory.
We'll delve deeper into the mysterious Jones Theory of game collection and introduce the Richard Postulate.
And on this episode's Buy, Try, or Deny,
Middle-Earth Quest.
Will you want to keep it for yourself or throw it into the fires of Mount Doom?
All this and much more on Game On with Cody and John.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, and role-playing games. Coming to you from beautiful Indianapolis, Indiana.
8-0.
I knew you were going to bring that up right away.
Yep.
The 8-0 Indianapolis Colts looking pretty good, as always, around this time of year.
Yep. Armageddon is this Sunday. We face the forces of evil. That is the New England Patriots. So by the time you listen to this, we will have already beaten them.
That's the hope.
And moving on to 9-0.
And you know, actually, I got a message from a listener, Toby Otero, who wanted to make a bet with me because he's a huge New Orleans Saints fan.
Yeah.
And wanted to know who he thought was going to, we thought we were going to lose first. Have a bet on whether the Saints would lose or the Colts would lose.
Oh, the Saints. I know they have an easier schedule. But
well, I told him that they're going to be playing the St. Louis Rams followed by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and that they would still lose first.
That's right.
So anyway, enough of that football stuff, although it's an exciting thing for us here in Indianapolis this time
That's
of year.
Our required 30 seconds of football.
Okay, now we're on to gaming. So what do we got going on today in the big deal?
Oh, the big deal. We've had a couple listener requests to kind of expand on the Jones Theory, which we introduced in episode,
I don't remember what it was.
The Collector's Edition was the title of it. Just kind of my theory behind game collections, and so I'm going to be explaining that. And we have the Richard Postulate, which we're going to be adding on to.
That's right, a bit of a corollary or proviso, quid pro quo, or whatever that goes along with the Jones Theory. But we're going to just talk about building game collections, and specifically the Jones Theory. We've got some interesting discussion on the Jones Theory and about how to build your collection. So we'll talk a bit about that, and then in our Buy, Try, or Deny.
We've got Middle Earth Quest. It's the one of the latest big box games from our good friends at Fantasy Flight Games.
And it's a big box game.
It is a meaty.
Yeah, lots going on there, but we'll have a full review of that and hopefully give you some good information as to whether you want to pick that one up. But as always, we start off with the Game On Inbox, and that starts
promptly. The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it. Well, listeners, it is time for the Game On Inbox, but before we delve too far into the inbox, we like to do our due diligence to the man, and the man in this case is our great sponsor, Myriad Games. Tell us all about it, John. All
right, as we've said for many episodes, Myriad Games, a great, friendly, professional game store in Salem, New Hampshire, and you can check them out.
Live free or die. Sorry, I was a little
you were late
on
that one, yeah.
Sorry.
But you can also check them out at myriadgames.com. And one thing I want to mention about Dan is, and one of the things that he is always talking about regarding friendly, professional game stores is that sort of special customer service aspect, that touch point that you're not going to get with a friend, an unfriendly, unprofessional game store.
We'll tell you all about it.
Right. And so I had a situation where I was interested in the game Castle Panic, which we're going to talk about in a review in probably a little later episode, but kind of a cool cooperative game that's come out recently. And so I, you know, emailed Dan and said, hey, do you have a copy of this? And he said, yep. And, you know, can we put it on your order? He's always very quick to throw that onto the order for
well,
us.
You gotta be.
Yeah, no, I mean, and so I said, yeah, sure, just throw it on there too. And so he sent that with our most recent order, and I got it in the mail, and I looked on the back of the box, and there was a big 3-inch gash in the box.
Oh, my.
Dun, dun, dun. But, you know, in a situation like that with an unfriendly game store, I mean, you could take it back, you get your refund or whatever, but, you know, it might be a hassle, but... And in this case, this is a company that is in a completely different state from me. So I got on the email, actually Google chat there with Dan, and just said, hey, here's what happened. And he was on it immediately. Like, you know, he gave me a lot of options as to, you know, how he could resolve the issue to make sure that I was a happy customer. And then he also said, I'm writing an email as we speak to the shipping department. And, you know, he just looked like he was going to be on it to make sure that, you know, something like that didn't happen again. So, you know, I got the good consumer feeling there that, you know, he was taking care of me, you know, that he
You can tell he definitely cares about his customers. I mean, he is, that's his customer service seems to be his bottom line.
And it's that kind of relationship that I think you're going to get from Myriad Games and from other professional game stores like that. Another thing I want to mention about Myriad Games that's a little bit unique for that sort of a business is Myriad Games has a whole set of podcasts called Myriad Games Presentations, and they come out pretty frequently, more frequently than our show.
Sure.
And they do all kinds of different things. They have one called Game Gab where they do interviews and things like that. So recently they interviewed Todd Rowland from AEG. That's the company that made The Adventurers that we reviewed on the last show. So real cool interview with them. They also do what's called Session Impressions where they get a group of folks together, sit around and play a game and do a review and just talk about it. So recently they've done Middle Earth Quest, which we're going to talk about in our By Charge and I, Last Night on Earth, and also the new hotness in Eurogames, Endeavor. So if you're interested in those, go and check them out. So we invite you to go to iTunes, subscribe to Myriad Games Presentations, and do it. Okay?
Wow.
I'm just
forceful.
I'm just saying. All right. So thanks again to Myriad Games for sponsoring our show and for being such a great spearheading a great movement in the game business.
Thanks, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dan. Well, now that we talked about a great game store, let's talk about great games we've been playing. So, Cody, what have you been playing?
Well, for Halloween, actually, it was on Halloween Eve, so the 30th of October.
All Hallows Eve Eve.
Indeed. Kayla and I hosted kind of a small gaming party at our place, and we played all Halloween-themed games. So we had, John brought the glut of the games over. You know, we had things like Last Night on Earth and Zombie Flux and Fury of Dracula and things like that. So we had, how many would you say we had?
10 or 11.
10 or 11, like we had a good, it was a nice little small gathering. And we kicked it off with some games. I know in the dining room they were playing Zombie Flux.
Yes,
and
having a raucous time with that.
That seemed to be going well. In the game room, we played a very good and very brief game of Fury of Dracula.
Wonderful game of Fury of Dracula.
I had never lost as Dracula until that night, and I got just hammered.
I got to expand on this just a little bit, because Cody pulled one of the greatest ruses I've ever seen in a game of Fury of Dracula. So, for those of you who never played, in the Fury of Dracula, Dracula is secretly moving around the board while all the hunters are trying to chase him and figure out where he is. It's got kind of a Scotland Yard deduction sort of element to it. And so you don't really exactly know where he might be. And there was a situation where one of the players, one of the hunters, moved out of England and was moving around away from England. And Cody just offhand, sort of almost under his breath, said, "Oh, you should have stayed in England longer. You shouldn't have left England so soon." And, you know, we almost didn't catch it. We said, "What?" And Cody gave us this look like, "Oh my gosh, did I just say that out loud?" And it was so convincing. And he's like, "Oh no, I didn't say that, did I? And we're like, "Oh, you totally did." And one of his friends, who's known him for years, is like, "Oh, that's totally your inner monologue coming out." You know,
that was great.
And so, you know, we then changed our whole strategy to go towards England where we thought he was. And then something a little bit later revealed one of his earlier locations. He wasn't anywhere near England.
No.
And so, and then he just shook his head at us and said, "Why do you have to be so gullible?"
In my defense, I lost because there was a between their ally and a few event cards that they drew. Fate was conspiring against me that evening, because had that not happened, I think I would have gotten away pretty easily, because I had you guys pretty fooled, but combination just completely screwed me, and then I got caught in the daytime and combat. And
just barely in the daytime. You know, in this game, Dracula's stronger at night. It was almost to the nighttime, where the nighttime would have been the right time for him, and we got him. So a very well-played game, but we were very happy to finally get the victory over Count Cody.
Yeah. We did play the game that we played quite a bit of that surprised me was Are You a Werewolf?
Oh, my.
the famous kind of Looney Labs game of mob justice.
How long did we play that?
We played a couple hours.
Oh, my
easily.
Gosh. Yeah.
I mean, and we kept saying, "Oh, this is the last one." And then we'd keep playing and keep playing and keep playing.
Cody kept asking. He was the moderator for a good portion of the night, and he kept saying, "So, one more game?" And everybody would look at each other and go, "Yeah, okay, one more game." Yeah. So we had a great time with that.
And we played that for quite a while. And then those that stuck around for the nightcap, we played Last Night on Earth.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where Kayla and I were playing the zombies, and we won a narrow victory.
And you were playing the Die Zombies Die, yep, or like kind of the first scenario, right?
Yeah, and we won only because one of the heroes got a little too cocky. You know, the idea is you have to kill 15 zombies in 15 turns, and they had like 6 turns to go, and they had racked up 13 kills already.
Oh, so, wow. I mean, they had that's a win right there.
Yeah, I mean, they pretty much just have to stay away from us and shoot us. And they yeah. He decided he wanted to come at us. He had a chainsaw or something. He decided he wanted to come right at us and give us the business. And, and you know, we tore him apart. And we already had 1 kill on the night, so that was our second one. That was a win
for
us.
You only need two hero kills to win.
Right.
Wow.
So, yeah.
But that's a great one. I love Last Night on Earth, and especially on a themey night like Halloween, mm-hmm. it's a really great one to play.
Yeah, that one definitely doesn't hit the table enough, but we had a really good time, and everyone seemed to enjoy it. So that's pretty much what I've been playing.
Awesome.
All right, what have you been playing, John?
Well, I've been doing some painting. Just going to start with that, I guess. I'm slowly getting through my miniatures that I purchased for War Machine. I'm now on my Revenger, and I'm almost done with that one, and I'll get them all based up. And I promise that I will eventually have a sort of session report of playing an actual game of War Machine.
The figures look great, if nothing else.
Thank you. So and really enjoying the painting and hobby aspect of this whole deal. So a lot of fun there. I also had a chance to play a board game at work. I've been playing a lot of card games and stuff, and of course, Magic is always an option at the lunch table at work, but I decided to bring in a copy of The Adventurers and try to play that during a lunchtime, and you know, it worked out great. We had a 4-player game, and I was able to teach the rules, and we played through the whole deal and still had 5 or 10 minutes to spare in our lunch hour.
To eat.
We ate first, and then... It must have been even less time than that, because we ate first and then we played and had some time left over. So, it went really, really well. Everybody enjoyed it. And I think because we had some less greedy players, everybody got out, although one just by the skin of their teeth, single L, almost got crushed by the boulder. And I think it was like a 3-point victory for someone. So, it was really – that was probably the most fun I've played of that game because everybody got out. I think most of my other games have ended with the boulder – plugging the exit and, no one getting out. So that's a fun one. So, if you have a lunch group that you might be able to play with, that's a good one. That's a good time frame for a lunch game, The Adventurers. And also, we just received a copy in the mail. We talked last episode and during our interview with Andy Looney, we got a copy of Stoner Flux.
Dude.
I haven't had a chance to play it yet, but I've looked through the cards and it looks... pretty funny, you know, and so we'll probably be publishing, I think we'll probably do like a written review of that one that you'll be able to find on Board Game Geek and on GameOnPodcast.com, so be looking for that in the next week or two.
Man, what?
Dude, if I can get around to it. All right, so that's pretty much all I've been playing. So let's go ahead and get into some emails that we got in the Game On inbox from some of our wonderful dear listeners.
Right, and these are... ones that are outside of the Southern Hemisphere, at least as far as we know.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
We'll get to that in a moment.
But why don't you kick us off, Cody? What are some good ones we've got here from our friends?
Well, we have a good friend of the show, Matt Swetnam. He wrote in about RPGs for kids, and he has 2 smallish children, and I know he's run events for them. And he had some very good suggestions. He said his first suggestion is one called Fairy's Tale. It's written by Patrick Sweeney and published by Firefly Games.
By who?
Firefly Games.
Patrick
Sweeney.
This is Patrick Swayze. Like,
wow.
Too soon?
Too soon.
Okay.
He says it's a basic RPG where players take on the roles of 4 different kinds of fairies: pixies, brownies, sprites, and pukas. The whole thing is designed with kids in mind.
I hope so.
The rules are purposefully kept simple, and there are side notes throughout the book that give advice on how to present the game to kids. He's had an opportunity to run a game of it, and he can't say enough good things about it.
Wow, I never heard of that one. That sounds cool.
And his other one, and this sounds pretty cool, is called The Secret Lives of Gingerbread Men. It's written by Annie Rush, and it's available print-on-demand through lulu.com.
That's lulu.com.
Right. The concept is that during the 12 days of Christmas, gingerbread men come to life and have adventures in your house. Players take on the roles of said gingerbread men. As he understands that players use real gingerbread men sort of like a character sheet, giving different powers based on the way they decorate it.
And he
says, how freaking cool is that? I have to echo, that is pretty freaking cool. He hasn't had a chance to play it himself, but reviews that he's seen have been very positive. That's pretty cool. And those are 2 great ways. So again, that's a Fairy's Tale and The Secret Lives of Gingerbread Men. So,
wow, those are some really great suggestions. Yeah, awesome. Kind of off the beaten path there.
Absolutely.
Very cool. We got another email in from Andrew Royal, who wanted to talk to us a little bit about miniatures wargaming and the investment in that. He says, for $75, you can get into either 40K or fantasy with the Assault on Black Reach or Battle for Skull Pass box sets. It says both contain a good selection of minis for two armies per box, rules and scenarios that intro the rules in a gradual stepped manner. It says he highly recommends either or both. Check them out. And I went and took a look at these online. And yeah, for those of you who listen who are into these games already, you're probably like, duh. But yeah, and Assault on Black Reach looks pretty awesome.
I'd have to say out of the two, I'd probably choose 40K.
I think I probably would too. Just my interest is probably more in the futuristic thing than in the fantasy. But you know, that may be something I'll pick up because I'm having so much fun painting these miniatures. And even if I don't get around to playing War Machine, just having the miniatures will be cool. So for $75 to get a bunch of miniatures that I can assemble and paint, and then, you know, Cody and I could actually play a two-player game of it. That sounds kind of tempting. So,
you know, Andrew's probably secretly like a regional sales manager for Games Workshop.
Probably so.
You know, guys.
And then for only $20 more, and then another $20 after that. So, yeah, well, I guess
in all seriousness, though, thank you for these suggestions.
No, I appreciate it. And of course, we've got other emails from folks that have said, you know, don't get into the black hole of 40K, that it will suck your whole life away. But, you know, I'm treading carefully so far. I'm just treading carefully.
All right.
Who else we got?
We got an email from Eric Bouchard from Quebec City, Canada, or Quebec City. I've heard it pronounced Quebec, but I say Quebec.
Quebec?
Quebec. Never mind. Eric Bouchard from Quebec.
Take off the Canadians now. Great.
Whatever. First of all, he wants to give us a chance to redeem ourselves and show to the world how knowledgeable we are with this about geography with this simple question. Which way is Canada from Indianapolis? That'd be north, of course.
He said that he has a little smiley. He says smiles. That's a patronizing smile, Eric. I just want you to know that.
I think I was right on the whole New Zealand-Australia geography.
I don't know.
I like
this. This is how sad this is. I've actually looked on the internet trying to find the distance between New Zealand and Indianapolis. You know how hard that is to find on Google? Like, you'd think there'd be some kind of calculator that would just tell you that. Mm-hmm. No. really quite difficult.
But he goes on and says that he's been listening since episode 5. Thank you.
Wow.
And you've been good traveling.
1 through 4 were pretty good episodes, too. You can
They weren't bad.
Go check this out if you want. I don't know.
And we've been good traveling companions on his portable play ever since. He loved the interview with Andrew Looney. Thank you. And we'll make sure to check his games out. I love card games, so Flux will have to be first. Definitely. Yep. Yeah, if you haven't played Flux,
pick it up.
Play it yesterday. He was wondering if we were planning, as a follow-up to the Hammer Time! Episode, a review of the Warhammer Invasion card game. And he says, keep up the good work, guys. And that's it.
Okay. Well, you know, regarding Warhammer Invasion, I did learn that, did a demo of that game at Gen Con with my buddy David. And it's a really cool game, and I had a chance to play it. And you know what? I had the box in my hand, and I was standing in line.
Did you?
I literally was standing in line. There were two people in front of me in line at the Fantasy Flight Games booth, and I put it back. It was one of only 3 copies that were left at the convention. And I just couldn't pull the trigger to spend the $40 for it. And not because of the quality of the game at all, but just because I just didn't feel like, after we played our demo game, or when, you know, Cody and I would review it or whatever, I just didn't think it was ever going to get to the table again based upon the people that I play with. So we're probably not going to do a full review of Warhammer Invasion, although I do think it's a really cool game. But we would recommend that you go check out another great podcast in the Pulp Gamer Media Network, the D6 Generation, who just on their last episode... I think it's 42, somewhere around there. They do a full review of the Warhammer Invasion card game. Very, very detailed.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Thanks, Cody. Yeah,
no
we'll
problem.
Link to it in the show notes.
10 more minutes of work.
Yeah, thanks a lot. But yeah, we'll link to it, and you can go check it out there. Those guys did a real extensive review of it, and the way they feel about it is kind of about the way I feel about it, too. So
very good. Well, thanks for writing, Eric.
Yep, thanks, Eric.
Appreciate it. And we've got one more non-Southern Hemisphere-related one.
Yeah, we got one more email from Ben Asaro, who wrote us last time, and he was talking to, he wanted to give me a word of warning. He said, 40K's fluff is very addictive, John. If you value your sanity, you will cut bait while there is still time, as that way madness lies.
He's actually a regional manager for Privateer Press.
Must be, yeah. no, 40K is a Games Workshop.
I know, he's trying to tell you not to get into it.
Oh, right. I didn't. Yeah, it must be late. Sorry.
Joke on with Cody and John.
You're way more witty than I am. But yeah, he says that there are literally scores of books and source material to sift through, and it all equally serves both the tabletop game as well as the RPGs. Wow. He said, if you're going to start a Dark Heresy campaign, he says, have you considered where you get a scenario from? Well, I really want to start a Rogue Trader campaign. I'm probably not going to go the Dark Heresy route. One of the things I like comparing Rogue Trader to Dark Heresy is I like the fact that in Rogue Trader, you can play kind of more heroic characters. Mm-hmm. Where Dark Heresy, you're just kind of playing these sort of peons who are working for the Inquisitor. And so I kind of am more interested in playing a game where it's kind of more Serenity like you're, you know, big damn heroes.
You could always just run Serenity.
But that's not the same.
Okay.
Okay. But then he says that, you know, why not pick up the Eisenshorn Omnibus from Black Library? He says real well written, and said, and then of course comes the question of the miniatures for the encounters. It's all very insidious. He says, I hope you enjoy your time in the pit. I'm worried now. I'm worried that I might be treading on bad territory here. Anyway, he just says that he's not really a fan of Dark Heresy. He says it's a bit clunky, and he's never been a fan of the D100 or the, you know, I guess the percentile system.
Percentile. You say it like a British person.
Okay.
You throw out the vowel.
What's wrong with British people?
Oh, jeez.
Got you there. Anyway, so he says that he's awaiting the first installment of the RPG Corner, or whatever it is we decide to call it, Cody's RPG segment.
Yeah, I'm taking suggestions for that. So if you have we said we were going to start this one. I think we're going to start it in earnest next one because I'm getting some material put together for it. But if you have a suggestion for the name of the segment, go ahead and send it to us at the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
And we'd love your suggestions because Cody's RPG Corner, it sounds kind of dumb.
So. It really does. Yes. You got to be able to come up with some kind of really cool name for it. I don't know what it's going to be.
It's beyond my power.
Okay. How about Know Your Role?
Oh.
You get it like from The Rock.
And, 10 years ago. That's cool.
I'm old. What can I say? All right. Well, anyway, Ben, we really do appreciate those comments. And please write us again. Now, as far as other emails to the Game On Inbox, of which we did get quite a few.
My mercy.
The main ones that we got, as Cody said, were from the Southern Hemisphere. Now, just to give you a little bit of background on this whole situation with New Zealand and Australia, we received emails from an Australian listener telling us that you know, he got Game On listeners in Australia. Hey, hooray, you know. And that sparked an email from Nathan Clark, a New Zealand listener, saying, hey, there's, you know, New Zealand listeners too, which sparked another Aussie to write in and say, you know, we can't let the Kiwis get the better of it. Well, that has opened the floodgates here. Yep. And so the New Zealand gamers have gone absolutely crazy go nuts down under there. And are you allowed to say down under?
I was just about to ask, is that copyright Australia?
We're learning more every day. So
we are pissing New off Zealand the world listeners, one country at a time.
New Zealand listeners, tell us if we're allowed to say down under about New Zealand folks or if it's just an Aussie thing. We're learning more every day. Anyway.
It's fun.
So Nathan Clark, in addition to writing us back at the Game On Inbox, also put out a call on BoardGameGeek.com in the New Zealand Gamer section saying, hey, you Kiwi listeners of Game On, send an email to the Game On Inbox to show your support of the show and the support of New Zealand. And oh my.
Respond they did.
They did indeed. We got quite a few New Zealand. The count now stands at, I didn't even do the math real well. I think it must be like 7 or 8 Kiwi emails to 2 Australian emails. So you know, the Aussies need to kind of step up here.
I know we might have to, one of the emails was talking about rugby and how the New Zealand team, the All Blacks.
The All Blacks.
That's an interesting name.
I like that name.
I think it's cool. Intimidating. And we saw we watched a video of their haka, the intimidating dance. I mean, that'd scare the crap out of me.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, New Zealand listeners, this is for you.
And as the smoke continues to hang around Eden Park, the All Blacks prepare to do the haka.
So I don't know the first thing about rugby, but I want to get like an All Blacks t-shirt now and be like, hey, look at this, you know?
Yeah, wasn't that cool? I mean, that's some intimidating sounds right there.
We'll have to learn rugby. I mean,
I don't know anything about it. But hey, we could end up being the Northern ambassadors to New Zealand gaming. You know?
That's right.
I don't mind having that distinction. I mean, we have no other distinction, so we might as well be that. But so New Zealand listeners, you know, keep the emails coming. Aussie listeners, keep the emails coming, you know?
But isn't their rugby team like the Wallabies?
I think that's what the Wallabies.
All Blacks sounds pretty.
Pretty impressive. Awesome. Yeah, I would feel much more scared of the All Blacks than the Wallabies.
Wallabies are cute. You want to cuddle them, you know?
Exactly. All right, so that closes the book for this episode on this battle of the...
The war continues.
The war of the Southern Hemisphere. But I'm having a lot of fun with that, so you know, we really appreciate all the listeners that have written in to support that great rivalry. The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big. Nobody Jones. Nobody Jones. I got a birthday present from Nobody Jones. I just don't feel so pleasant toward Nobody Jones. All right, well, welcome to The Big Deal. This episode, we're going to be talking about an aspect of game collecting. We've done an episode before called The Collector's Edition, where we went through all these different ideas of how to build your game collection. And when we did that episode, a particular theory came about.
It was born, I would say.
It
was
born out of that discussion, which we have dubbed, or Cody has dubbed, the Jones Theory.
Yes.
And so we want to dig down a little deeper into the Jones Theory this episode to talk to Cody. I'm gonna play like the Morley Safer, the Ed Bradley, the Ryan Seacrest, you know, interviewer.
You went downhill with him.
I did. And just talk to you about the Jones Theory. We're just going to talk about, because the reason, okay, I'm just going to back up. The reason why this has even come up is the fact that I have too many games. I just have too many games, and I'm trying to kind of cull down my collection and figure out a way to get to a manageable level. And so Cody and I have just been having discussions casually about how to do that. So it brought up this whole thing of the Jones Theory. So without further ado, Cody.
Hi there.
Tell us about the Jones Theory, and just lay it all out for us. What is the Jones Theory, and how did you come about coming up with it?
In honor of Dan from Fear the Boot, I'm first going to tell you what the Jones Theory is not.
Oh, thanks, Dan.
The Jones Theory is not for everyone. I know that a part of board gaming can be the collector aspect.
Sure.
And I don't fault people that, you know, they have 300-400 games, you know, that's cool, you know.
What about people who have 600-700 games? Do you fault them?
No, I don't fault them.
1,000 games?
No. At no point do I fault them.
Okay.
To me, I feel like I'm a kind of a bottom line kind of guy, mm-hmm. and I'm very, Cannon will tell you, I'm like the anti-pack rat, you know. It's like, if we haven't used it in a year, then we need to pitch it or give it away or something, you know.
Uh-huh.
I like to run a tight ship in that regard. And so I kind of found with gaming that if there were board games I didn't need, I needed some way to kind of delineate which games I would keep in my collection, which games I wouldn't, which is where I developed the Jones Theory.
Uh-huh.
You're just going to keep saying go on, go on.
Go on.
Okay. I'll go into it. The Jones Theory, I'll first say it is not intended for two-player games that have a playing time of 30 minutes or less. It
okay.
does not apply for those.
You can have as many of those as you want.
Right.
Okay.
It does not apply to kids' games.
Okay. Can we go back one? Why?
I don't know.
It just doesn't. Okay.
Yeah. I find like a lot of two-player games have similar theme or mechanics, but I think you can never have too many of them because
okay.
I think with two-player games you can play them quickly, especially if they fall under that 30-minute or less time frame, and it's good to have a good variety of those.
A lot of them come in small boxes too,
right?
So real estate,
and they're cheaper, you know.
Okay, I got you.
So here's the Jones Theory.
Oh, you were saying the kids games too, right?
Kids games, yeah, not
yeah. Have 1,000 kid games if you want.
Yeah, whatever the kids like. Yeah, okay. I don't care.
Gotcha.
The Jones Theory works in that if you have a game of a certain type in your collection, you should only have one kind of game of that type. I'll for example, if you have Battlestar Galactica, the board game.
Which I do. It's a great game.
It is a fantastic game, and I own it as well. I would say it would be not wasteful, but it would be kind of unproductive to have a game like Shadows over Camelot in your game collection.
Which I also have in my collection. It's a very good game.
And then here's how I define the buckets, as John called it.
This is the part I'm waiting for here, because in our discussions before we turn the mics on, this was my problem with the Jones Theory.
Now, the idea sounds great. You know, one game of each type. But then the real tough question becomes, how do you determine what a type is? And so you start getting into all these little buckets of, well, it's a worker placement game with, you know, that's less than 5 years old and has, you know, it's for 2 to 5 players rather than for 3 to 5 players. And then you got the cooperative with trader, cooperative without trader. You know, how do you determine what the buckets are? And Cody's giving me nods here, like he's about to tell me how to do that.
Okay.
All right, let's hear it.
I was struggling for a long time to get this down to a hard and fast rule, but just today I solidified it, the thing that was just kind of moving around in my head.
The heavens opened up and you got the word.
That's right.
Okay.
You either have a game in your collection based on theme or based on mechanic, whichever is more prevalent in the game. And I'll give you an example. Battlestar Galactica, while it has that BSG theme, the thing that drives that game is the cooperative with trader element. Would you agree? Would you say it is more about that? The theme is strong, the theme is well done, but at its core, it's meant to be a cooperative game with a trader element.
I'm not sure if I 100% agree with that, because the theme is so thick in that
game. It is thick, you know? but the driving force behind that game, and you'll see with my other example.
Okay, I'll grant you that. Yeah, I mean, it is probably the most glaring, if you will, semi-cooperative or cooperative with trader mechanic that I've seen. So
sure.
I'll grant you that.
And an example of a game that is heavier on theme than mechanics, I would say would be Last Night on Earth. Because that game, you bring that to the table because you want to play a zombie survival horror game. You right. don't play it because you want to necessarily play a miniatures
yeah.
you know, combat thing. You know,
it's got that, the most innovative dice mechanic ever.
Right. That game is about the theme.
That's true. Absolutely.
BSG, I say narrowly, you know, maybe 55-45,
yeah.
is more mechanic-based than theme-based.
Okay.
So you pick a category there, and then you ask your, you know, say I have Battlestar Galactica in my collection. That is a cooperative game with a trader element. And I bring in Shadows Over Camelot, which I would also, I would say that is more cooperative game with a trader element versus medieval game.
Yeah, oh, know? I agree, yeah.
And so I decide which one will be in my collection, because it's not even a space or a money issue. It's a value issue. To me, if I'm having a game night with my friends and it's like, hey, let's play a cooperative game with a trader element, you know, they wouldn't say it like that, but you know, you're going
to pick the right group. They might say that.
Well, true. Yeah. Knowing my group, but you're going to pick the one you like better anyway.
Yeah.
So 9 times out of 10, and really unless you have a really active game group that plays that all the time, you're not going to play it that maybe more than once a month.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, you're always going to pull out the one you like better, and that one will continue to hit the table more because the group will know the rules, you'll get to know strategies on it, and that will be the game of choice. So I apply that to all the games in my collection. Give me an example. Or
okay. Now you said, do party games count for this too, or were you saying that party games were kind of along the lines of like kids games?
Yeah, I would probably exempt party games too. Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's see. How about a game like, how about a train game?
Okay. So like,
would train game be a category?
Yes, to me it would. Because okay. Ticket to Ride, to me, you play Ticket to Ride because it's more of a train game than you do. It's a, you know, connecting 2 points and,
okay.
you know, card element game. That is a train game. To me, I know it is very simplistic as far as the wide realm of train games. Train games are very boring to me anyway, the bigger ones.
Yeah.
But as far as Ticket to Ride would be classified as train game.
Okay. And you would only, in the Jones theory, you would only have one train game in your collection.
Yes.
Okay. So I want to make sure I understand about the whole thing between theme and mechanics. So,
okay.
So you're saying that you would make a bucket of theme,
mm-hmm.
which would be, you know, train game. Now, if you had something that was a particular mechanic, now some of the train games like Age of Steam, Railroad Tycoon, to a lesser extent, the 18XX series, these are all Euro games that you don't really like, but,
sure.
but for example, the, you know, Railroad Tycoon is about, it's a train game,
mm-hmm.
but it also has some real strong mechanics in the, you know, delivery of goods, also in stock and money management and that kind of stuff. So would you consider, if you were interested in a game like that, if you were able to cull out the mechanics of that game,
right?
Would you have a copy of that along with Ticket to Ride because of the mechanics, not necessarily because of the theme? Is that what you're kind of saying here, with theme versus mechanics?
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. I probably still wouldn't, because I mean, if I'm going to play that, I mean, that This is all very, you know, kind of self-centric too. Depends on the user here. But to me, that's just heavier train game. I mean, if I was going to have both of those games in my collection, I would have to delineate it as light train game, heavy train game.
Okay.
But they're both train games.
Okay. Well, let me give you an example of a game that doesn't exist.
Okay.
Let's say that you had a game that was set on a train.
Okay.
Like the theme was on a train,
mm-hmm.
but it was a cooperative game with a trader element.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that cooperative game with trader element was better than Battlestar Galactica, which I know is your favorite cooperative
right.
game. But if you found that if this game came out, it had a train theme,
mm-hmm.
but it was cooperative with, would that supplant Ticket to Ride as your train game, or would you keep them both because one would be considered train game and the other one would be considered cooperative with trader element game?
If it were better than BSG,
yes.
It would replace BSG. Because the idea, when I say train game, at least in my mind,
yeah.
I'm thinking of connecting routes and delivering stuff and yada, yada, yada. If it's set on a train, that's cool and all, but it's still a cooperative game with trader element.
Okay, so ultimately, in your categories, you're still going to have a list of things that are kind of probably Cody-centric, right?
Yeah.
Definition of a train game is close to the general definition of a train game, but some other people might...
Right. Some people would just scoff, I think, you know, at saying that, oh, you know, Ticket to Ride is not in the same ballpark as...
Right. It's like Metro. You know, Metro is a tile-laying game about subways, yeah. but it's kind of got a train sort of element because you're
that
kind
falls
of
into tile-laying game.
Okay.
Pretty much, you could give me the title of any game, and I can tell you the bucket I put it in, and it would generally only fall in one bucket. Now he's looking at his game collection. So.
Okay. All right. Let's do that for a second. Okay. Dominion.
Dominion right now is its own kind of creature. It's
probably the only deck building.
Yeah,
style
deck
game.
Building collectible card game in a box. Yeah.
Okay, there's one just came out recently called Arctic Scavengers, which I've not played, but
heard it's good though.
Yeah, I heard it's kind of pretty good. Anyway, so how about Fury of Dracula?
Fury of Dracula, to me, I put it more mechanic than theme, so it's not necessarily like a horror game or whatever.
So you take each game individually and you're going to classify it. Is this a, do I care about this game more because of theme or because of mechanic? Is that what you're
right,
saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it has its own thing because it's a cooperative game. It's like a cooperative antagonistic game. I don't know really how to, you know, it's many people are cooperating against one fixed opponent. There's not a traitor element because you know Dracula's bad from the beginning.
Okay.
And, you know, I would almost say that's, I would just call that cooperative game.
Okay. What about Descent then?
Descent to me falls into. Boy, how did.
I only mentioned that one because that one is also everybody against one person.
Right.
So it, in that respect, it's similar to Fury of Dracula. I agree with you with whatever you're about to say, which is that it's going to be a very different game. But.
Sure. Descent is actually one of those really tough ones, whether I would define it on theme or on mechanic. I guess I would define it on mechanic as, you know, kind of like a dungeon crawl, you know, tactical move. Almost like I would probably actually just, in my own mind, as a D&D light or a fantasy RPG substitute in board game form.
This all makes sense in your head, right?
Yeah, I know. Everyone's going to listen and be like, what is this guy on? but to me, you know, that's a game someone plays that wants to play D&D but can't play D&D.
Okay, so something like Memoir 44.
Yeah, Memoir 44, Battle Lore, Command and Colors, you pick one. They are not different enough to me to have all three. And I know that will cause some flack, but I think you only need one. And that one's Memoir 44, by the way. they all have that Borgian element, you know? I look at that as...
The Borgian element, I like that.
light war game, like a weekend war gamer sort of a thing. You know, just very light system, card driven, troop movement. Yeah, Battle Lore adds some stuff that Memoir 44 doesn't have, which adds some stuff that Commands and Colors doesn't have. But they're at the core of the same game.
And I agree with that. Mechanically, they are pretty much the same game.
So I would say just have one of those.
The only thing where I get a little bit, it gets a little tricky for me,
mm-hmm.
Because. If you look at my collection, I mean, I own Battle Lore and Memoir 44.
I'm looking at them right.
And they're right next to you. I don't necessarily subscribe to this idea. And one of the reasons why, I think, is because theme is really important. I know theme is important to you, too.
Absolutely.
You know? And we've talked about that before. But if I have a game that has a particular kind of mechanic. Let's say worker placement, you know. And I like the worker placement mechanic, and then I own five games that have different themes with worker placement. I don't guess I see anything wrong with that. If I like that mechanic, because you know, because maybe I want to play a worker placement theme, a worker placement game with, you know, the like a farming theme like Agricola, or mm-hmm. I want to do a worker placement theme with the caveman theme like Stone Age, you know. Right. So that's where I it's hard for me to choose one based upon mechanic.
The way I cut that down, and this is different for a lot of people, is if it's not, if it hasn't really hit my game table more than once or twice in a year, then to me it's not a good enough return on investment for me. Like if I have, you know, like at one point you had Command and Colors Ancients along with, I don't know if you still have it or not.
No, I put all the stickers on those wooden blocks. Yeah. That took about 3 hours.
Yeah.
That was terrible.
But the thing is, you had that, you had Memoir 44, you had Battle War.
I mean, it was terrible, dude.
We never played it. I mean,
I want to go back. Putting those stickers on the blocks, that was terrible. I mean, that was torturous. I think I need a moment. Okay.
The moment passed. But to me, you had those other games, which I would say you thought were better. You think Memoir 44 and Battle War is a little better than Command & Colors?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And so you picked that when we played it. We never played Command & Colors. So to me, even if you only play that once in a year span, you're not really getting a good ROI on that. And in defense of that, you say, well, you know, I like to play that. That's fine. Because normally you can play that at like Origins or something, you know.
Yeah.
Origins
yeah.
is a great time to play, you know, maybe what you don't have in your collection. I just don't see where spending your money on it and having the space taken up in your collection for something else is always going to trump it. Why have it in there?
Yeah, and I almost think that also becomes a function of overall collection size.
Mm-hmm. You know,
if you only own 10 games and five of them are worker placement games, then those five may all come out at some point, you know,
because right,
you don't have that many games, you know. But you're right. I mean, if you got 100 games and you got five worker placement games, probably only one of those is going to come out. Okay, you know, I'll grant you that. Mm-hmm. And it's a good segue because now I want to talk real briefly about the Richard postulate.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's, you actually have mentioned it already. You didn't know that.
Oh.
I don't have a whole lot of criteria for how I select my games other than that looks cool.
Yep.
and then I buy it. And sometimes it's a good decision and I'll end up picking up something that I'll keep for years and years. Sometimes I'll buy something that, will, you know, eventually leave my collection pretty quickly. But I think that the Richard postulate, as I will state it now, is that if a game has not hit your table in a year, it should not be in your collection.
I agree.
I think that should be a pretty hard and fast rule. Even a game like Twilight Imperium 3rd Edition or Diplomacy, games that are kind of event games, you mm-hmm. know, where you got to get a group of people together who are going to be committed.
You
got to
plan it out.
You got to plan it out.
Right.
A good example is the fact that next weekend we are actually going to be doing a full game of Diplomacy. We got the whole thing planned. We'll even tease you that our next episode may be completely about Diplomacy. Just saying.
Yep.
but even a big event game like that, if you're not able to get it to the table at least once in a year, why do you even own it? You know,
well, so completely agree. I even consider that part of the Jones theory. So
okay, all right. Well, so that's the Richard postulate to the Jones theory,
sure.
or any other theory you might want to apply.
Right.
But that's one rule that I think I want to try to keep. And as I look around my collection, there's quite a few games that haven't hit the table in a year that I think I'm going to want to start getting them to the table to start the clock,
mm-hmm.
or going ahead and getting rid of them because. I think it's just a common thing among gamers that you see something cool and you think, wow, that would be really cool to play. And you get it and you open it up and you look at the pieces and you read the rules and it's cool, but you're never going to get to the table. You don't have the right opponents or you don't have the time or you're too busy painting miniatures or whatever.
Right. And one of the other reasons the Jones theory kind of came about, other than my personal thrift and, you know, just having a functional game collection is the fact...
And curmudgeonliness.
And an old man curmudgeonliness, because I am an old man at 26.
Oh, yeah.
Is the fact I hate learning games.
Like, right.
I hate that first game where you're learning. And it seems like with a large game collection, every game you play always seems to be...
Like it's the first time
like
you
the
play
first
it.
Time.
And even it if it's not.
Drives
yeah.
me nuts. So with the Jones theory, you have that one cooperative trader element game, and you know, the idea is if that's the only one in your collection you've been bringing it out, people will, the circle of friends in which you play, eventually they'll all learn it. You don't have to teach it. And then you can just sit down and play, and you can start getting into more advanced games of it and see some more, you know, some advanced plays instead of kind of the fumbling you see in first games a lot.
That's a good point, and unfortunately that flies very much in the face of the cult of the new, of which, as much as I hate to admit it, I tend to be a member of. When the new stuff comes out, it looks cool and I want to get it. But you're absolutely right. I can pull out my copy of Shadows Over Camelot, which is one of the first hobby-style board games I ever owned. And I can teach that cold, you know, I never have to look at the rule book of that game again, you know. Nope. And there is some great benefit to that, because if someone wants to select that for a game night, I know that it's not going to be any sort of a slog. We can be up and running in 15 minutes. So I'll grant you that. So there's the Jones theory.
I presented it well. I kind of worry that it sounds like this incoherent.
No, I mean,
curmudgeonly thing.
No, I think it makes sense, and it is very personal. I think. Yeah. I think it really applies to your tastes and.
But
what,
there are good concepts.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I think it's something that other folks could apply. You know, think about theme, think about mechanics, kind of go one direction or another, and then make your selection based upon that. You know, add the Richard postulate if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, we might in our episode thread for this on the Geek, we might even put, you know. Bring your Jones theory dilemmas and
yeah,
like I have this and this. What would you do?
Or you know, present your own fill in your name here theory.
Sure, absolutely.
And tell us about that. You know, we'd like to know, because you know I've looked on Board Game Geek and seen you know the profiles of people that own anywhere from you know five games to well they probably own more than that and just don't have them cataloged, but you know up to I think the biggest collection I've seen is like 1,300 games.
Oh God.
So. You know, so what's your criteria? You know, yeah. When you get to 1,300 games, you probably don't have a criteria.
Yeah,
is it a game?
Like
I'll buy,
which is fine,
and that's fine too. But you know, if you have limited space or you know limited money, you know, how do you make those selections? And so that you know, the Jones theory, I think, is a sound one. It's not one that I think I 100% ascribe to, but you know,
as I look at all these games around me,
well, I'm probably moving in that direction though. Now, to that end, to kind of wrap things up here. I am doing my very best to cull through my collection a little bit and to, you know, hopefully make a little bit of money for Christmas because that's coming up soon. And so I have created a Geek List auction. It's the second one that I've done, although we didn't really advertise the first one, so it didn't get a whole lot of press, I guess. And I'm going to be selling about 15 of my games, 15 or 16, something like that.
There's some good ones in there.
Some good ones. We've got actually my copy of Agricola, my copy of Puerto Rico.
Good man.
I've got
Cleanse the Evil.
Quiet. you know, some games.
Cosmic Encounter?
The new Cosmic Encounter and also A Touch of Evil. These are both the games that we reviewed on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Again, great games. And if you go back and listen to our reviews, you know, we said they were great games. But just, they haven't gotten to the table. A Touch of Evil is probably the game that helped to define the Richard postulate for me, because we reviewed that on episode 2 of the show back last September or something like that. It's been a year. We have not played that game again. It has sat on the shelf for a year. And so it needs to go to somebody who can bring it to the table a little bit more.
Good
so,
man.
Anyway, so, you know, I'm going to be putting all those games up there, and I've got the cool United States Postal Service flat rate mailer boxes, so the shipping should be pretty reasonable, and I'll put all the details there. I'll put a link to the Geek List in the show notes. It'll be up there for a couple of weeks, two or three weeks to, you know, get bids, but I'd invite you guys to go and check it out and maybe bid on some games, and, you know, we'll even throw in one of our Game On business cards. We'll sign it if you want us to sign it. but that's you know my little contribution to the Jones theory. So you have affected me positively, Cody.
Very good. So if you have, like I said, if you have your own theory, or if you have questions about the Jones theory, the Richard postulate, or whatever, go ahead and send us an email at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
And we will take care of your problem in due process.
All right. Well, so we'll just close the book on this big deal. Good discussion. Yeah.
We'll see.
We'll move on to our Buy Try It or Not, where we're going to be taking a look at a huge box game that may or may not be in my collection in a year. We'll find out. And that's Middle Earth Quest.
Buy, Try, or Deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple.
Don't wear the ring. I know it's very tempting. Yes, yes, you will appear to disappear. But the dark riders, they'll know you're there. Yes, Lord Sauron has many spies.
Many spies have many eyes.
One ring to find them, to find them. One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them, one to find them. One ring to rule them all. Yeah, 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 yeah. You got to rule them.
All right, it's Buy, Try, or Deny time, and we are tackling one of the new hotness games from Fantasy Flight Games, the latest in their big box line, Middle-Earth Quest. Just when you thought they couldn't release any more games based on Lord of the Rings, well, they got you one better.
The search for more money.
That's right. So this is... again, quite a large undertaking, and it was an interesting game to play, and John's going to give you the rules rundown.
That's right, and we're going to break this up into real small chunks here, because... I'll let you in on a little something here, listeners. Every time we get ready to do a review, Cody's taking Vegas odds bets on how long it's going to take for me to spit out all the rules. So, you know what? This game is huge. It has a ton of rules, and it is a lengthy... meaty sort of a game, and so it would be, I think, boring for me to go through every detailed bit of the rules that I can.
I concur.
Yeah, you can always check out the rule book online. So I'm just going to kind of hit the high points here, give you a flavor for what the game is about, the goals and everything.
Enough for you to make a decision on.
Absolutely, and that's the main goal here, is that when we do Buy, Try, or Deny, we want to help you guys to make a good decision about a possible game purchase.
To spend your gaming dollar.
That's right. Hopefully at Myriad Games.
Wow. We already shilled for them, all right?
You can never shill too much.
You have nothing to lose but your chains.
Exactly. Okay, so as the book here, the rule books here says, the events of Middle-Earth Quest are set in the lands described in J.R.R. Tolkien's epic novel, The Lord of the Rings.
Heard of it?
Yeah. The game takes place during a time span of 17 years. The years from when Bilbo celebrates his 111th birthday... And that's also Frodo's 33rd birthday.
Cool.
Getting that down, just make sure you knew how old everybody was.
Go on.
2 days just prior to Frodo's leaving the Shire.
Which I read the book and I forgot that was a 17-year span, because the movie doesn't really...
No, the movie, it's like a week, it seems like. Right, Gandalf goes and gets his library card out and goes to the library, and then he comes back and he's ready for Frodo to leave. So yeah, 17 years, and it says, these are years of high adventure and mounting darkness. Will you take the mantle of a hero, helping Gandalf and the White Council in their struggle against the Shadow? Will you help set the stage for the days that follow, as described in Lord of the Rings? Or will you take the role of Sauron himself, seeking the domination, corruption, and enslavement of all that is free and kind? Will you, as the Dark Lord of Mordor, succeed in finding that for which you hunger most, the location and return of the One Ring, before Gandalf's plan can mature?
Franchise opportunities available.
Whatever the choice, the fate of Middle-earth is in your hands. And so that's kind of the flavor and overview of the game. That's sort of what you're going for here.
It's like the Mary Sues of Middle-earth.
The what?
The Mary Sues.
What's a Mary Sue?
It's like this kind of... with like the fan fictions, these like kind of tag along characters. Like if you're reading a Harry Potter fan fiction, it's like Harry's lost brother,
Right, right.
So you get all these characters you can play as that are like, who? Right.
You don't get to be Gandalf in this game. Right. You get to be
like Jack Bilbo from Gondor,
Exactly.
Doing his thing.
Fred the dwarf.
Yeah.
So one player is going to take on the role of Sauron, and then between one and three other players are going to take the role of some sort of nondescript hero. Character. And in this game, you're going to be trying to further your story. The idea here is that there's a big story track on the top of the board, and there are going to be different things in the game that will cause that story track to move along. Also, at the beginning of the game, the hero players are going to get a secret mission card, as will the Sauron player. And so the goal is that by the time one of those tokens hits the end of the story track, you're going to turn over those mission cards, and whoever has completed their mission will win the game. Now, if both players have completed their mission, or if both players haven't completed their mission, then the game comes down to one big final battle where your strongest hero is going to fight the Ring Wraiths, which is one of the minions of Sauron. And then the outcome of that battle will determine the end of the game and whoever the winner is. So the process to get to that point is a lengthy one, and there's lots of stuff that goes along with that. And so you're going to start off in the game with your character on the board for the heroes, and then Sauron doesn't have actually, a character. It's the big eye of Sauron. But he has a lot of things at his disposal, including minions. There are five main minions that are represented by miniatures in the game. There's there's the Black Serpent, and there's also the Ring Wraiths. There's the Mouth of Sauron, the Witch King, and one other. But you got these five.
And all the rest.
Yeah, and what's this? And the rest crap. So those minions are going to be on the board at certain times, at certain phases in the game, kind of going around and wreaking havoc on all the heroes. There's also monster tokens that can be placed on the board at certain times that, again, can possibly wreak havoc. The interesting thing about the monster tokens, and when they're placed on the board, they're just cardboard chits, is that 60% of the cardboard tokens are actual monsters when you turn them over. 40% of the tokens are nothing. They're just blank. And so they represent like rumors of monsters that might have been there, something like shadows, you know. And so that adds sort of an element of surprise in the game as to, you know, and gives the heroes something interesting to look forward to, I guess, as to if they go into a space with a token, is it going to be a monster or not? Do they want to take that risk? That kind of a thing. So the game works in turns where you're going to have a Sauron turn followed by the hero turns. And so I'm just going to go briefly through how each of the turns works. And again, a real high level overview. And then we'll talk about the end game condition and tell you what we thought about it. So the Sauron turn is going to start off with what's called a hero rally step. So Sauron's currency in this game is influence. And there are these little red round tokens. And Sauron's going to start off with minions in two locations on the board and can sort of radiate out influence from those locations. Whenever you're able to place influence tokens out on the board, that's going to allow you to place monsters, move your minions around, things like that. So it's a really good visual way when you see it on the board of Sauron sort of spreading his influence around all of Middle-earth and sort of, you know, the long arm of Sauron, you know, moving across the land there. And so the very first step in the Sauron turn is that if there is a hero in a location that has influence tokens on it, then you're going to get rid of those. So Sauron loses his influence in any of those locations where the heroes happen to be standing. Then you're going to have what's called the story step. Again, this is the real meaty part of the game that you're really trying to advance these story tokens. The heroes have one story token. Sauron has three different story tokens. And so, based upon the Sauron mission card, he may want to move one of his tokens farther than the others, or there may be a certain way that he wants to have those tokens move around. The hero token's pretty easy. Every turn, the hero token moves two spaces down the track. And so, no matter what, that sort of almost sets a timer for the game in that, you know, after a certain number of turns, the hero marker will get to the end. The Sauron markers may get there sooner, but it's not going to be any slower than that, than the hero turn marker. So you'll advance the hero turn marker two spaces. Then the Sauron markers are going to move based upon plot cards that are being played. On the board, there's this huge, it's really huge. I mean, it takes up like almost a third of the board, a picture of a tower. I assume the Tower
of Barad-dûr.
The Tower of Barad-dûr, yeah. And on this tower, there are three spaces where cards can be played that are called plot cards. And these plot cards will affect certain locations. So once you play the plot card, you're going to put a token on the board at the location where the plot card affects it. And then it's also going to have some kind of an icon that will show that a particular colored story marker will move. There's a red one, a yellow one, and a black one. And so each of these plot cards will cause those story markers to move. These are the main ways that those will move for Sauron. And so you'll move the hero token, then you'll move the Sauron tokens, and that's the story step. Then you're going to have what's called a plot step. So I mentioned those plot cards. Sauron now has the ability to option to play a plot card onto one of those three spaces. Or if all three of those plot spaces are empty, he can remove one that's on the board. So the Sauron player can sort of plan out a strategy. He'll have a few of these cards in his hand, and he can put them down and decide, you know, maybe he wants to move the yellow token more so he can, you know, so he'll add another card that'll move the yellow token, all that kind of stuff. So that's the plot step. Then you're going to have what's called an event step. In the game, there are event cards there's three decks of those, one for each phase of the game, one, two, and three. The phases of the game are based upon where the story markers are. And the story track at the top of the board is pretty self-explanatory as to whenever a token moves into that second phase, that activates that phase, and you'll be drawing event cards from the phase two deck instead of the phase one deck. These events are kind of standing effects that do cool things or bad things, depending on you know, which one you draw. And so you're going to resolve one of those event cards in the event step. Then the main meat of Sauron's turn is the action step. And Sauron has three options of what he can do on his actions. And this is all spelled out on the board as well. Sauron can choose to use influence, so he can place influence tokens onto the board. He can draw some cards. He's got what's called a shadow deck in addition to the plot deck. The shadow deck are just some effects that can be played that can mess up, you know, can mess with the hero players. And so you can draw a certain number of those and draw a certain number of plot cards. That's sort of how he replenishes his supply. Then the last thing that he can do is to choose to move monsters or minions around, or to place new monsters and minions onto the board. Now, the mechanic for this is kind of neat, because on the board, there are kind of spaces where you can put these action tokens to say what you're doing. So Sauron, when he wants to do influence, he can put it onto the influence space. And there's three spaces on the influence part of the board. One has like a 6, one has a 5, and one has a 4. So if he places the action token onto the 6, then he'll take 6 influence, and then that one will be covered up. So when he takes his next action, he won't be able to do the 6. He'd have to put his action token onto something else. Sauron's going to get 2 actions total on his turn, except for in a 4-player game where he'll get 3 actions instead. And so, you know, there's always more things to do than you have action tokens to do them with. So Sauron's got to make some decisions as to whether he wants to get cards, place influence, or move monsters around, because he'll have a real limited opportunity to do that. So after the action step, then the very last thing is the hero draw step. And that isn't really a Sauron thing so much as every other hero player is going to draw a certain number of cards to sort of replenish their hand to get ready for the hero turn. So that is the Sauron turn. So then after the Sauron turn is complete there, you're going to have your hero turn. You'll start at the left there and just move across the table clockwise, and each hero will do their turn in succession. So let me just back up for a second and talk to you a little bit about the main arsenal of stuff that the hero player has, and that is a deck of cards. Each player has a what they call a life deck. So you use these cards for movement, and you're also going to use them for combat, and they're also going to represent damage that you take on during combat. So on your player mat, that has a picture of your guy on it there, there are three areas, one to the left, one on top, and one to the right of that main card. The left area is your life area, and then the top area is your rest area, and then to the right is your combat damage. So whenever you do a movement step, you would actually discard a certain number of cards from your hand to your rest area, and that will allow you to move. If you're ever in a combat situation and you take on damage, you have to discard cards from your hand or from your deck, your life deck, over to the combat damage area. So slowly this deck of cards is going to be depleted. If you ever run out of cards in your hand and in your deck, your life deck, you are defeated. And then basically they drag your lifeless body to a city.
Not quite lifeless.
Not quite lifeless body to a city and... You
a
basically,
house of healing.
You basically come back to life, you know, but you lose some of your stuff, you know. So this is really interesting because, you know, now instead of having hit points or life points or whatever, you're moving a token or something, you have this deck of cards. So it's real easy to visually see, you know, how much life you have left. And because of the choices that you have to make with your cards, it makes it real interesting, the decisions you have to make regarding this life deck. So... the first step from the hero's turn is called a rest step. So if you decided that instead of moving, you wanted to rest, you're going to take all of the cards that you have discarded to your rest area for movement in previous turns. You're going to shuffle those back into your life deck. And so that would be, you know, you resting. So you get all those cards back. So that's more movement points you're going to get. After you rest, possibly rest, then you're going to have what's called an ambush step. If you happen to be in a location where there's a monster or a minion that has parked there on the Sauron turn, then the Sauron player has the option to attack you, and more than likely they will.
He will elect to take that option.
Yes, I played Sauron in our game, and I attacked pretty much every time that was an option. And so then you will go through a combat round. The combat round is very simple. The combat system is very easy. On these cards, you're going to have a hit value as well as a defense value, and then you might have some kind of a special ability on the card. Again, these are all the same cards that are in this life deck. They're one deck of cards. And then whenever Sauron fights, depending on what minion or monster it is, he has three different decks of cards that he's going to draw cards from depending on what kind of monster it is. And then it's basically choose a card. Each player lays one down, the hero and then the Sauron player. And then you're just going to compare the attack value against the defense and the attack value, the other attack value against the other defense, and deal damage accordingly. Damage is dealt simultaneously, and then if the Sauron player is dealt damage, then he's going to take actual wounds, and there are tokens to represent those wounds. If the hero player is dealt damage, then like I said, you're going to discard a certain number of cards from your life deck or your hand into that combat damage area. And then there are going to be situations where you'll become exhausted and that might end the battle. So it's not one of those things where you fight to the death each time. You know, usually you're going to defeat the monster if it's a hero. Not always, but... So that's the ambush step and sort of how combat works. Then you have an option of doing a travel step. And the movement in this is really kind of cool because on the board, in between each of the locations on the board, there is a number and an icon. And it might be something like a mountain and maybe like the number 3. If you wanted to move between those two cities where you see a mountain icon and a 3, you either have to discard a mountain card, which is one of those life cards on the bottom right of the card. It'll have some kind of a symbol. And if it's got a mountain symbol, you just discard one of those. Or you can discard 3 cards of any type in order to make that movement. So you can travel around. You can do that as many times as you want. And then depending on if you have gone into what's called a perilous location, and there's lots of rules regarding perilous locations, you might have to take cards and have bad things happen to you and all that kind of stuff. And if you go into a location that has a minion or a monster in it, then you may have to do a combat step at that point. And so you'll resolve those things. So there's lots of stuff to do on your turn. The currency for the hero players is a lot of times these things called favor tokens. And they're going to appear on the board based upon cards that are played and lots of other things. And so one of the things that they're going to be trying to do is to collect those. The nearest thing I can think of a comparison is in Arkham Horror when you have to collect clue tokens, mm-hmm. which you'll eventually use to close those gates. The favor tokens are used to help to discard plot cards. So those plot cards are played by Sauron to help to further his story. And each of those plot cards affects a location. If the hero player goes to that location and then is able to discard a certain number of favor tokens that's mentioned on the plot card, you can remove that plot card. So this is the way that the hero players can fight back against the progression of Sauron's story, is by discarding those favor tokens. So you're going to want to try to go to those locations that have those tokens. And so the hero player is allowed to do as much of this traveling and exploring as they want to on their turn until they run out of cards, basically. And then the last thing is going to be an encounter step. Wherever they end up, they're going to draw a card from a deck of encounter cards. And there's, I think, 6 or 7 decks of cards that sit on the board that are different colors. And based upon where you are, you'll draw 3 cards out of that deck. And then you're going to resolve the card, one of those cards, the one that applies to the location that you're in. Or if there's multiple cards that apply to your location, there's a priority number. And you'll pick the lowest priority number and resolve that card. These could be good things that happen. They, I think, more than likely tend to be bad things that happen, if I remember right.
Yeah, it's usually not very good.
Yeah, so you'll resolve that encounter step. And then that will be the end of the hero's turn. Then you'll move to the next hero until you get through all the heroes. Then you'll move back to the Sauron player's turn. From that, it's lather, rinse, repeat. There's a lot of additional complexity added in. There's lots of different kinds of decks of cards and things like that that might affect you. But that's the basic flow of the game. And so the game is going to end when one of those tokens reaches the very end, or there's a particular part about 3/4 of the way through the story track that they call the Darkness Falls space. And if all 3 of Sauron's tokens pass that Darkness Falls space, that will also trigger the end game. So like I said, while this is all going on, there's going to be a secret mission card that each of the hero players collectively have one, and the Sauron player has one. And when you get to that end condition, the finale, you're going to turn over those cards and see if you've done it or not. So if you get to the end and you've completed your mission and the other ones hasn't, then it's an immediate victory. And that's kind of, I think, the way you would want the game to end, mm-hmm. is by completing your mission and getting your story all the way to the end. That's not the way it happened in our game.
We went to overtime.
We went to the overtime, where you actually will select one hero that you consider to be kind of the strongest, who will then battle with the Ring Wraiths, which is one of the stronger minions in the game. And whoever wins that battle, well, and it basically works out to if the Ring Wraiths are defeated, then the heroes win. And if they're not defeated, then they lose. I mean, you could end up with a situation where both parties are alive,
mm-hmm.
but if you don't defeat the Ring Wraiths, then
they have the Ring Wraiths have the advantage.
Right, right. And so that's the would be the end point of the game. So that's kind of a basic overview. How'd I do?
All right.
I tried to go as fast as I could.
That's a meaty game. That was well done.
And so we played a 4-player game of this, and I think it was a good 3 hours,
mm-hmm.
a good 3 to 3.5
yeah,
hours,
I'd say 3.5.
With rules explanation and that kind of stuff. I'll go ahead and shut up, take a drink of my drink here. And Cody, why don't you tell me what you thought of Middle Earth Quest?
Sure. I thought this was, I have a passing knowledge of Lord of the Rings. I mean, I've read the books, I've seen the movies, and I have some friends that are a lot bigger Lord of the Rings fans than I am. But I thought it was well done. I thought the theme was interesting, trying to have this, kind of the background characters, what were they doing in this long gap in the history. To me, it played a lot like kind of a variant on Runebound.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Or like an Overland adventure game, something to that effect. I thought
walk
it was...
Walk around, fight stuff.
Walk around, fight stuff, collect stuff. To me, I really like the card system as far as using it for combat and using it for like a life pool, and the cards were so they were used for many things, and then I thought that was a really neat mechanic. So kudos for that.
Yeah, one thing I didn't mention about that is that if you're dealt combat damage with those cards, they go into that combat area.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you you can't get those cards back unless you go to a special location to get healed.
Right.
And so that's the only time when those cards will come back into your hand. So really clever, I think, about how that works. But all right. So, and what did you think of the end game? I'll go ahead and just pose that question there, because I think we both felt a little bit kind of wonky about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, very anticlimactic. I mean, you've played up for this 3.5 hours. You end in a tie, basically, and then it's like, you pick your team captain, you go fight the Ring Wraiths.
Yeah.
and that determines whether you, and you may have, what irks me is you may have had many fights with the Ring Wraiths already.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem special, it's like.
Because the Ring Wraiths, if they, unlike the other minions, if they, quote unquote, die, they actually get all their life back and they just go back to another location. They're undead already. So.
It just seems very kind of rushed from a game design standpoint. It's like, there's a tie, fight the Ring Wraiths.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
It almost seems like if they could have made it, if they could have made it all players fight the Ring Wraiths, but instead it becomes beef up one guy and everybody else just kind of sits there and just says, go Bob,
Yeah, I wasn't real thrilled with that,
yeah.
But I don't know a better way to do it.
Well, I really liked the game. I thought it was, like I said, very meaty, and I'm trying not to be overly biased about that, because I'm sort of finding that I'm liking meatier games less and less,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's just a time factor. It's harder to find, 4 hours to sit and play a game and really get into it. And usually games that are of this depth and complexity, you really need to play them more than a couple of times to really get into it. So this is one that, we're making our judgments based upon one play, but I'd like to get this to the table a couple more times, to really get a good feel for it. Because I think it is very well designed. It's really themey. I mean, it's really cool the way they've got all the theme and the car. The flavor text is just all over the place and really makes a lot of sense. One thing I didn't mention is that you have the opportunity to interact with some of the more well-known characters from the story, like Gandalf and Saruman, before he went bad.
Right.
And Boromir and those kind of those guys will appear on the board at certain times and you can go and interact with them. So that seemed kind of cool.
Yep.
So overall, I really did like the game. I probably just would need some more plays. And I got to say, I think that end game choice is pretty weak.
Yeah, it sucks. Yeah.
So let's go to our ratings. Middle Earth Quest, Cody, buy, try, or deny?
It's going to be a try for me. I will say the theme of it both works for and against it. I would say if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, and by that I mean you've read the books and maybe some of the ancillary books like the Silmarillion or any of the other kind of lost tales of Tolkien, anything beyond that, then I would say it's a buy. If you're into the Middle-earth lore and the Tolkien, then you'll eat this game up. You'll really like it. But it works against it, where a lot of the flavor text and some of the background stuff, you may be just completely lost with it. And it's such a part of the game that you're not really getting the full thrust of the game because you're not understanding, you know, the significance of the cards necessarily. I mean, the mechanics are different from the theme, but
yeah,
you get my gist. It's a solid game. It's definitely worth trying out. I think it's got some redeeming qualities. It's fun to play. But give this one a try. But if you happen to be a big-time Lord of the Rings fan, then I think the theme alone will push it to a buy. And it's crafted well enough to where the mechanics will be fun for you. But this one's definitely worth a second look. So it's a try for me. John, Middle-Earth Quest by Triad and
I think it has to be a try for me, too, just because it's not enough. There's not enough there. That's going to just push it to buy, where I would say, you know, everybody, you know, you need to go out and pick this up. It of course isn't a deny. It's very well designed. So it's got to kind of fall in the middle for me. And when I think of this game, I actually compare it to another really meaty Lord of the Rings game. That's War of the Ring, another mm-hmm. Fantasy Flight product. And I really enjoy War of the Ring, probably a little bit more than this, but for those of you who have played that game, as a comparison, this game is very, very different. It is very much a story-driven sort of game. You know, the story track, and you know, trying to kind of walk around, like Cody said, collect things, fight things, those sort of things. Whereas War of the Ring is really almost a military strategy game with some story elements laid over top of it.
That sounds fun.
That's right. I forgot you never played it. Mm. I actually used to own a copy of it, and then I think it was before I met you, and then I ended up getting rid of it because I never thought I'd find an opponent for it. But I had an opportunity to play it a couple of times.
Now, you're getting me that new, really expensive collector's edition for Christmas, right?
No, I don't think okay. I am, actually. But
it's like a 5-foot-tall box or something?
It looks awesome.
It's huge.
So, you know, if you're a War of the Ring fan, you know, you may like this because of the Middle-Earth Quest, because of the theme, but don't think that it's a similar game, because it's very mm-hmm. different, except that it's of probably similar complexity. But I give it a real, real solid try. If you go to a convention where they're playing a full game of this and you can sit around with someone who can really teach the rules, that might be a fun way to spend an evening at a convention playing through this one. But, you know, definitely give it a try before you pick it up. But it's a good, solid game. Corey Kanitska, I forgot to mention, he was the designer of this game, along with Christian T. Peterson. And really, really good. Really, another really great one from Fantasy Flight.
So two tries from us.
Yo, Frodo, what you doing wearing the ring? All powerful jewelry, is that your new thing? I know it's hard when you little mall, 3 foot fall, a little lost so close to floor. Trying to lead the fellows to the gates of Mordor, the fellowship.
Yeah, the fellowship!
But I don't rap about bitches and hoes, I rap about witches and trolls. Pass on the words of the elven king. Wisdom to all, Frodo, don't wear the ring.
Well, I think it just about wraps up episode 32 of Game On with Cody and John. Thanks so much for listening.
Absolutely.
We got a few more things we want to mention to you before we go. One is our website at www.gameonpodcast.com, where you can check out all of our previous episodes, as well as some written reviews that we've put up there and lots of other great stuff. We had some people solicit or ask us to put up more videos. We may pull out the my wife's MacBook and make a couple more of those in the future. But
Maybe we'll get some videos from the Day of Diplomacy coming up.
Possibly so.
Maybe.
Yeah, good segue there. Join us in 2 weeks because we're going to be taking a look at the game Diplomacy, a classic. And we're actually going to be running a full day, what we call the Day of Diplomacy.
Yep.
And we've got a big group of people coming over, a full complement of 7 players, plus Cody as your referee and moderator.
That's right.
He's going to be taking around the recorder, and we're going to be doing some recording during our game, and hopefully it'll be a lot of fun. If you've never played Diplomacy, as we never have,
nope.
we're coming at this with fresh eyes. We want to take on this classic and you know, see how it goes. Hopefully we'll still be friends at the end of it.
Maybe. That's why I'm being a moderator.
Yeah. So look for that in 2 weeks. And we got a lot of stuff, great stuff coming up towards the end of the year here at Game On with Cody and John. And we really do appreciate all the support and emails and all that kind of stuff that we've gotten from you guys. We really feel like we're a podcast that's up and coming, you know, that we're on the upswing.
Yep.
So if you have anything that you want to share with us, we'd invite you to write at the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Yeah, we do. Any kind of comments you want, if you're an Australian or a New Zealander, or you know, if you want to, if you're from another country and you want to throw your hat into the ring of, you know, the biggest contingent of Game On listeners, we would welcome that. We'd like to mention also that on our website we have our donation button. We do appreciate donations. That does help us to defray the costs of all that it takes to put on the podcast, get us on a good financial footing. We appreciate that.
And everything goes back to you.
It does indeed.
And as we sign off, we'd also like to mention that we are proud members of the Pulp Gamer Media Network.
Very proud.
You can check out our show and other great shows at pulpgamer.com.
All right, well, I think it's about time to get out of here and do some stuff.
Time to hit the old dusty trail.
That's right, yeah.
I got to prep for diplomacy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Are you going to wear like a... Are you wearing a referee shirt?
I'm going to wear a referee shirt,
That's going to be awesome. All right, well, until then...
Game on.